For our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service now presents... Indie Week, The Independent, and this week's issue read by John Feddersen today, and it's dated November the 20th of 2025. Well, let's move right into Customs and Border Protection agents now in the Triangle. As a matter of fact, as of yesterday, they are in Raleigh, but they appeared in Durham a couple of days before that. And this is an article published on the 18th. Scenes of panic, paranoia, and solidarity unfolded across Durham on a Tuesday as U.S. Customs and Border Protection CBP agents descended onto the Triangle. At Beauty World, a beauty supply store in a strip mall on Avondale Drive, an employee was taking out the trash around noon when she witnessed federal agents chase three people in the back parking lot and handcuff them, according to the co-owner Abraham Kim. "They're just kind of grabbing people right now," Kim said. Durham County Commissioner Nita Alam confirmed three people were detained outside Beauty World, saying she witnessed the detentions herself. The operation in the Triangle comes amid Operation Charlotte's Web, in which over 100 people have so far been detained in Charlotte, another Democrat-run city targeted by the Trump administration as part of the president's efforts to ramp up deportations. At the entrance to Beauty World, Sincere Jones stood, manually opening and closing automatic doors for individual customers as a safety measure in the wake of the detentions. And she said, "What they're doing is not right." Adding he previously worked as a state corrections officer in Virginia, and he had, quote, "never seen anything like this." As news of the sweep spread, a sense of fear was palpable at Hispanic grocery stores. At La Superior on North Roxborough Street, customers were fleeing the parking lot, whipping their cars and trucks at high speeds after a group of Siembra, North Carolina volunteers showed up around 1 and said agents were coming there next. Employees closed down the store and pulled the gates to the parking lot shut after that lot emptied out. At Compare Foods on University Drive, the store remained open at 1:30 p.m., but uncertainty hung in the air. Some people driving in to do their grocery shopping stopped to ask volunteers positioned in the parking lot if it would be okay for them to stop. Noah Liguri-Bills, a volunteer with Siembra, North Carolina, wearing a neon yellow vest, told one shopper, "We have a lot of people here, so if you want to go buy groceries, it's good for now." Liguri-Bills told Indy that he and other volunteers were stationed at various spots across the Triangle where they anticipated federal agents might appear when they spot vehicle makes and models that are known to be used by these agents. They approach to confirm whether the occupants are federal agents by requesting badge numbers and asking what they're doing in the area. When they're verified, volunteers call a rapid response hotline that allows Siembra to track enforcement activity and warn community members. So far, the coast was clear at Compare, though the heightened vigilance created a moment of false alarm when a black SUV pulled into the parking lot. Dozens of people blew whistles and honked their horns. It turned out to just be shoppers coming to buy groceries. Well, more, another article, now this time based in Raleigh, the state capital. Federal agents are coming to the Triangle, and this was prior to the last one that I read. At least three people have been detained in Durham as CBP began this action in the Triangle on Tuesday. Raleigh Mayor Janet Cowell confirmed to Indy and the Assembly Monday night that federal agents were expected to be active in the city on Tuesday. Although Durham officials were not informed of any planned activity, individuals have reported seeing agents in the city And Nida Alam, who chairs the Durham County Board of Commissioners, said she witnessed three people taken into custody at that Durham shopping center. CPB's presence in the Triangle comes on the heels, as I read before, of Operation Charlotte's Web. 130 people at least were detained in Charlotte. A spokesperson for CIEMBRA, this immigrant advocacy group, said in a video on social media, "For those of us that have been following the developments in Charlotte, it can be difficult to hear that these operations, which have already disrupted the lives of so many trying to make their way to work and school, are being expanded. But as CBP looks to bring their operations to the Triangle, we know that it will find yet another community ready to ensure that every one of their neighbors is free to live and work safely." Why is Border Patrol in the Triangle? The Department of Homeland Security declined to comment on potential operations in and around Raleigh, but the actions come as the Trump administration targets blue cities as part of an effort to ramp up deportations. In recent months, Border Patrol has conducted operations in Democrat-run cities far away from the U.S.-Mexico border, including Los Angeles, Chicago, and now Charlotte. Republicans have pointed to crime in these areas, particularly the Charlotte murder of Irina Zarutska, to justify the presence of federal agents. Like in Charlotte, violent crime is down in Durham and Raleigh. Durham has been previously singled out by the Trump administration. Earlier this year, the Department of Homeland Security labeled Durham as a sanctuary jurisdiction. Durham officials denied that characterization, and an online list of jurisdictions that also included neighboring Orange County was taken down. Durham landed in national headlines again when the city council, along with Carrboro's town council, voted in August to join area businesses as Fourth Amendment workplaces. The Fourth Amendment Workplaces Initiative trains employers on what to do if immigration agents show up. In 2018, voters in five urban counties elected sheriffs who campaigned on pledges to curtail coordination with ICE, including Durham Sheriff Clarence Burkhead, Mecklenburg Sheriff Gary McFadden, and then Wake Sheriff Gerald Baker. Since then, the state legislature has chipped away at sheriff's discretion on whether to coordinate with ICE, requiring them to notify the agency before releasing certain people from jail and to hold them for up to 48 hours after their scheduled release to allow federal officials to take them into custody. Cowell, the Raleigh mayor, confirmed to Indy and the Assembly Monday night that Border Patrol was expected to be active on Tuesday, though Cowell said the city had not been informed of any specific plans. Cowell said, "While the Raleigh police are not involved in immigration enforcement, we are committed to protecting our residents and to following the law. This is a key moment to reaffirm our commitment to serving all members of our community. If you need help from the police, you call 911 and help will come. I ask Raleigh to remember our values and maintain peace and respect through any upcoming challenges." CIEMBRA NC, which helped lead rapid response to the operations in Charlotte and created a statewide map of ICE and Border Patrol activity, said in a call out for volunteers, quote, "We think the reports of Border Patrol traveling to Raleigh tomorrow are credible," adding Raleigh and Garner appear to be the likeliest targets. Individuals have reported sightings of agents in multiple locations across Durham Tuesday. And Alam confronted agents detaining people outside Beauty World. We've heard about that twice now. A police department spokesperson told Indy Monday that he had not been informed of any plans, operations, and noted federal agencies do not need to notify law enforcement locally. Alam wrote to Indy Tuesday morning, "Many Durham residents work in Wake County, and many Wake County residents work in Durham. We are one triangle, and we are great because of our diversity, and it is appalling that this administration is instilling fear that causes families to be concerned for their safety by simply going to work, dropping their kids at school, getting groceries, or even going to church. on Tuesday morning. Alum, Durham Mayor Leonardo Williams and Durham County Board of Education Chair Bettina Umstead issued a joint statement that affirmed the city's commitment to protecting immigrants, but did not address whether Durham would be targeted. The Wake County Public School System issued a statement on Tuesday saying, "The district does not ask for or record information about students' and families' immigration status and sharing resources for talking to children about what's happening." And the statement said, "Building leaders have been reminded of the procedures that law enforcement agencies must follow when interacting with students on campus. If law enforcement seeks access to a school, we will consult with legal counsel to ensure compliance with applicable laws." Finally, in this article, community resources. Several local groups have established these rapid response networks to support community members amid immigration operations. Siembra, North Carolina, coordinates volunteers to work shifts, monitoring areas considered vulnerable to enforcement activity, and has established a hotline community members can call to help gather information about the presence of federal agents. The Carolina Migrant Network provides free legal representation for people in detention centers and removal proceedings, and they can be reached at this phone number, 704-740-7737. This again, the Carolina Migrant Network, 704-740-7737. Durham Public Schools Strong, Durham for All, and allied groups are organizing school-based community response teams. Volunteers will gather near Durham Public School entrances Wednesday, today, Thursday, when I'm broadcasting, and Friday during drop-off times to hold signs, report federal agent sightings, and collect support requests from parents. My next article, also from Durham County, it's Durham County is creating a 10-year food security plan. It's preparing to assess its food system and create this plan to ensure food security. Durham Board of County Commissioners approved a $150,000 contract on Monday with Key Environmental Consulting, which will develop a food system assessment and strategic plan over the next 18 months. The goals for the plan include ensuring access to affordable, safe, and nutritious food that meets dietary needs and food preferences, assessing the conditions and job opportunities for people working in Durham's food industries, and using environmental friendly practices to protect waterways and wildlife. Durham is slightly below the food insecurity average of 15% in North Carolina, with about 14% of residents having limited or uncertain access to adequate food, according to 2023 data from Feeding America. However, food insecurity values are much higher for children, as well as Black people and Latinos, in comparison with Durham's average, 18.3% for children, 26% for Black people, and 22% for Latinos. Raina Bunag, North Carolina Cooperative Extension Food Security Coordinator, says, "The county government and our community members do so much for food security. There's always tons of efforts going on, but we never have enough resources or enough staff or enough volunteers. So this will help us to understand really how to prioritize the projects and how to better use the resources, both, again, internally and throughout the county, to make bigger change together." Key Environmental Consulting, which has experience working in Durham, will conduct a spatial analysis of food access that will detail grocery stores and markets in Durham, farms and other production sites in and near the county, and how food is distributed in Durham. The vendor We'll also review policies at local, state, and national levels to determine the best strategies to deal with food insecurity. The findings will be used to evaluate Durham's current efforts. The first 6 months of the project, which is expected to begin early next year, will be dedicated to meeting with Key Environmental Consulting as it creates a project plan. A steering committee will also be formed to help lead the assessment activities. Starting around the third month, data collection and spatial analysis will begin. And the last 6 months will be dedicated to developing this 10-year strategic plan, getting community feedback, revising the plan based on feedback, and publishing it. Bonag says the county has ramped up its already significant food security investment in recent years, investing more than $3 million in the American Rescue Plan Act, that's ARPA, food security projects, as well as a result of federal stimulus money during that pandemic. Emergency planning will be another focus of the strategic plan. The federal government shutdown, which disrupted SNAP benefits for over 30,000 people in Durham, reinforced the need to have emergency planning, says Bonag. Quote, I think it's great timing for a lot of reasons, but that is one part I'll be glad for us to have some data and recommendations around. Donna Rewalt, director of Durham County Center of NC Cooperative Extension, said during Monday's county's commissioners' meeting that food insecurity ebbs and flows like it did in the 2008 recession and the pandemic. Quote, we are used to a mill of different crises happening, and so there's never a right time to do something, but now is a good time for us to really be looking more deeply at this work so it can help us to be more prepared in the future. Now, folks, I may have alluded to this last week, I can't recall, but it's about the Durham City Council and historic Durham Athletic Park. This was filed on the 12th of November, so it could have been read, but again, it's lost in the mists of time. City Council voted to move towards preserving and restoring Durham Athletic Park at Thursday's work session, rejecting two other options, which would have removed the park and replaced it with a more traditional public park. Mayor Leonardo Williams said, I don't think our history has to be replaced. It's so much more than just the Durham Athletic Park. Audience members came forward to advocate on behalf of restoration. Julia Lassure, a representative of Preservation Durham, the focus should be on investing and enhancing what already exists, not replacing it with something new. The decision came after a year-long feasibility study from Perkins and Will, an architecture and design firm that explored three visions for the park. The study incorporated responses from over 2,600 community members. Zena Howard of Perkins and Will presented those proposals, emphasizing the designs were preliminary. The first, which was unanimously supported by the council, will preserve that ballpark, which was built in 1926 and, of course, featured in the movie Bull Durham, while making the park more accessible and comfortable with better wayfinding, lighting, and seating. This could mean renovating or replacing inaccessible bathrooms and walkways. Designers also envisioned replacing the fenced perimeter with a more aesthetically pleasing and open space. There would still be a functional barrier for use during games. Howard says there is a way to accommodate that without looking like a prison yard. That's to be desired. This is the most modest of those three approaches. They're small changes that make a big difference in how people move through and enjoy the space. Council members appreciated that the proposal maintains use of the park for sports. Councilman Carl Rist said, we don't want to miss the fact there is a need for baseball here. I'm a big fan of Project One. Former Mayor Nick Tennyson also showed up to speak in favor of restoration. We should try to preserve it. My own sons played down there. I hope you'll preserve that connection to baseball. Council member Didriana Freeman voted for that restoration approach, but advised caution. For instance, Stacy Poston with the City of Durham suggested that those historic bathrooms under the grandstand seats may have to be moved to increase the accessibilities. Freeman said, if the bathrooms were used by Jackie Robinson, I want to be careful we just don't dismiss all of the history that's included at this site. The two proposals the councils rejected called for removing the ballpark and using the site as a public space. The second proposal would keep the rough structure of the park but open it up to biking paths and walkways. The field itself would be converted to a large lawn for public events. And the third proposal envisioned an entirely transformative development. The sketches included a multifaceted park with elevated walkways, terraces, and play spaces. In this proposal, Ellerby Creek, which was originally routed underneath the DAP, would be brought back as a central water feature. The ballpark would be destroyed and replaced with playgrounds, elevated walkways, and terraces, with seating and event space. Marcus Manning from the Durham Sports Commission also lobbied for preserving the ballpark. Quote, the Sports Commission sees a unique opportunity for a reimagined DAP. In recent months, we've been in several conversations with three potential tenants. Manning also hinted at future announcements to come. Quote, I did connect with the professional league. We are having a significant conversation. Councilman Mark Anthony Middleton dug further. Are we talking to the MLB? He interrupted. Manning said, we have to keep it general at this point. We do anticipate an announcement here at the end of this month or early next month. Middleton emphasized the importance of making the right choices about this historic ballpark. This is going to be one of those generational decisions that we make as a city. The renovation is estimated to cost between $48 and $68 million. Several council members, including Freeman and Nate Baker, raised questions about this figure. Mayor Williams, who also ultimately supported the plan, also raised concerns. Parks cost a lot of money, he said. Most of the time they end up with some weird-looking thing, like a pimple out of the ground. I'm not interested in spending millions of dollars on something that doesn't catch your eye when you walk past it. Williams said, I'll never forget the light rail, referring to that failed Durham Transit project. We spent $150 million in design and consulting, and a shovel never hit the ground. That will not happen here. He also called for collaborating with other community organizations rather than having the city undertake that project alone. He said, take a Habitat for Humanity approach to building the dadgum park. We have a whole Duke University Pratt School of Engineering that could also get involved. These kids want to be more involved. The council asked Perkins and Will to move forward with design work, incorporating restoration plans and future athletic use for that park. And the final report is scheduled to be completed in early 2026. Well, the deadline on our next article from Apex on the 14th of November was when it was written. Dispute over Apex Friendship High School residential parking lot continues. Following a debate over a long-standing dispute at the Apex Town Council meeting Thursday evening, town leaders still have not found a good solution to what they've considered to be a significant problem in recent years. An Apex resident operating a for-profit parking lot in a residential area near Friendship High School. Outgoing town council member Brett Gant proposed a way for the council to try and move on from the issue before a new council is seated next year, but his colleagues voted against his idea, and the council is back where it started, with the issue likely dragging into 2026 beyond. Since 2015, Annie Scott has offered her property, that's a residential area on Humi Olive Road, located across the street from the high school, to students who need parking spaces. Scott charges $300 for the school year for a space, $100 more than the cost to park in the limited spaces on the high school campus. Her yard can accommodate more than 50 cars. The town of Apex has taken various measures over the years to try to get Scott to stop using her yard for student parking, including sending letters asking her to stop and notices of the town's intention to rezone the property from residential to commercial use, a move requiring an amendment to the town's UDO, which could come with its own set of regulatory problems. The property falls within Apex's extraterritorial jurisdiction, ETJ, of course. Members of the current town council have raised concerns about the safety of students crossing the street from Scott to the high school, as well as issues within the parking lot itself, including aesthetics and cars getting blocked in that the town says it cannot address without a rezoning. But Scott, who has been clear she doesn't want the rezoning to happen, has persisted. On Thursday, she appeared at the town council meeting with an attorney, Truth McDavid, who said she is not officially retained, to make her case that the town can't force her to stop leasing out parking spaces to students or fine her for doing it. Scott McDavid explained, paid $200 to the North Carolina Department of Transportation to designate her private property as a public vehicular area, PVA, that the DOT can regulate with official signage and other measures. There's no explanation on the books for why that statute exists, and only one relevant case to look to for precedent, McDavid said. That case, in McDavid's opinion, says the PVA designation, though there is no written explanation from lawmakers for its original purpose, effectively prohibits the town from taking enforcement action against Scott. McDavid said, you guys can zone whatever you want to, but once someone petitions the state, there's no way to undo that. In the precedent case, dealing with the idea that once we start talking about undoing what the state wants to do, it can't be undone by the municipality. State lawmakers had reasons for doing it, but nobody decided to write any of that down with the statute. Let me look back on when was that statute. Oh, well. Back in August, Apex Mayor Jacques Gilbert, at odds with some of his colleagues, declared the dispute over and Scott free to continue operating her for-profit lot since she had successfully secured that designation. But other council members, as well as the town attorney, disagree that the PVA designation preempts local zoning rules, citing information from the Department of Transportation and the League of Municipalities. The town attorney, Laurie Hoy, said at Thursday's meeting, the clear intention there of the PVA designation is to allow enforcement of motor vehicle laws on PVA property. And Lori Hoey said no one was trying to reverse or invalidate the designation. Quote, however, the question is whether that designation would preempt our zoning authority, and my opinion and others is that it does not. The state legislature has clearly given matters of land use control to local governments, meaning counties and cities. Gant's proposed solution would be to punt the issue to county leaders by removing the property's ETJ status. He said the property would come under the jurisdiction of Wake County. Gant argued that the high school, a county facility, has the authority to issue parking passes to students, and said it is looking at both short- and long-term ways to provide more spaces for students, including at a planned county library nearby and several other options. Gant said, my preference would be the county and their ordinances, which my understanding is they also prohibit this kind of parking. The county could have that fight if they want to with the property owner with some kind of enforcement on their end. Can't acknowledge that for either Apex or Wake, the fight would be costly and not a great look. Other council members disagreed. Terry Mahaffey said, this is our situation to deal with. Kicking it over to our friends in the county just so they can deal with doesn't really seem like a responsible thing to do. We took an oath to enforce the laws of APEX. We should be the ones to do it. Take the heat for it. Gant made a motion to proceed with relinquishing the ETJ, but it was voted down. So he made a second motion to direct staff to enforce the town ordinances in this case, however the town manager and planning director see fit. There was no timeline, nor further specifics, and it's not clear how that enforcement will differ from the action the town has already taken. Councilmember Arno Zegerman warned, before the council gave its unanimous approval to this motion, take into account the history here and the letters and notifications already duly sent previously. The town could also move forward with amending the town's UDO to rezone that property from residential to commercial, as it has already threatened, and let the legal process play out as it may. Each side seems convinced of its own chances of prevailing. In his public comments before that initial discussion, McDavid, the lawyer speaking for Scott, was confident that she has the state statute on her side. McDavid asked the town council for mercy and grace. Mercy in the sense, he said, that we could spend a lot of money arguing about this and Miss Scott could probably hire me to represent her, but I don't know who that would serve. He said the PVA designation overrides the enforcement authority to the county or the city. I hope this helps you. Helps kids have a safe place to park. It's in the best interest of the children and everyone, and it would save a lot of money. The council members took a different view. Gant said during the discussion, from what I'm hearing from the town attorney is that whether we enforce our zoning or the county enforces their zoning, it is unlikely the landowner would prevail if it comes to a judge deciding. It was Gant's last meeting before leaving the council after he declined to run for re-election to his seat this fall. He said at the beginning, I'm loath to let an issue like this fester into the next council, considering it happened on our watch. But after the council voted to stay the course, it looks like that's exactly what will happen. Another article now, this one about public and school librarians in Wake County. They juggle divergent challenges, writes Jasmine Gallup. Walking into the Leesville Community Library, it's hard to picture a quiet and welcoming space as the setting for any kind of political firestorm, let alone the one that engulfed Wake County Public Libraries a few years ago. Leesville Library Manager Kate Taylor was a key player in that fight in 2022, which took place over book banning and censorship. Taylor, who spearheaded the development of a new policy protecting the freedom to read, says the library administration today is supportive of, quote, highlighting books of all kinds, unquote, through book lists and public displays. That's a significant change from 2022, when administrators were under fire for considering the removal of genderqueer, our skin, and anti-racist baby from the shelves. The controversy highlighted a major divide between librarians on the ground and administrative decision makers, even as librarians nationwide faced a huge influx of attempts to ban books. Without the support of administrators, some Wake County librarians felt disheartened in their attempts to resist censorship. Last year, the hiring of a new library director, Tammy Badgett, in August of 24, gave some hope that a change in philosophy was also perhaps on the way. Taylor notes, it signals a change in leadership. We're curious to see where she takes us next. Of course, the new policy implemented in 22 is also a step forward. Many, quote, public-facing staff were involved in writing it, says Taylor. Putting the library's procedure for developing its collection and responding to book challenges in writing was, in the opinion of some, long overdue. But in accordance with national standards, the policy now includes language that library books may, quote, reflect controversial, unorthodox, or even unpopular ideas, and that, quote, only parents or legal guardians have the authority to determine the use of library materials for their own minor children. Taylor says, those are two phrases I felt were really important to be in there and I think really protect our collection. The policy certainly seems to have made Wake County Public Libraries more resilient in the face of increasing book challenges. With only one request for reconsideration filed this year, it's easy to believe Taylor when she says that the North Raleigh community is overwhelmingly supportive of the library's mission. But the quiet that is comforting here is very different from the silence that blanketed other libraries, as employees hesitate to speak up and draw attention to themselves amid the political battle over books. While some patrons are supportive of the freedom to read, libraries undoubtedly remain under attack. In the past 4 years, the number of books challenged across the United States has remained at record highs, according to data collected by the American Library Association, ALA. The number peaked in 2023 at 4,200 books challenged, more than 15 times the average number that were challenged between 2001 to 2020. Which was 273. And in 2024, more than 2,000 books were challenged across the country. Across North Carolina, at least 103 were challenged in 24, 91 of which were housed in school libraries. Among those, The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, and Ban This Book by Alan Gratz. Where parents were once the biggest initiators of challenges, libraries now face organized censorship campaigns that attack dozens of books at once. In 24, elected officials, board members, administrators, and conservative pressure groups like Moms for Liberty were responsible for more than 70% of U.S. book challenges documented by the ALA. From 2001 to 20, this group was responsible for only 3% of documented book challenges. In North Carolina, the number is even higher, with pressure groups and decision makers responsible for 85% of the challenges documented in 24. Laws attacking libraries continue to be proposed and passed in the state legislature. In July, the General Assembly passed a law requiring school districts to publicly post the names of all books in school and classroom libraries. Faced with hours of cataloging work and uncertain of the impact complying would have on their jobs and personal lives, many teachers opted to simply remove their classroom libraries, taking away one more route children have to reading. School librarian Michelle Wolfson, also a member of the NC Library Association's Intellectual Freedom Committee, says a lot of teachers do consider it a lot easier just to be like, I'm taking my library out. They're not going to deal with the nonsense of actually logistically doing this thing. They don't want to worry about ticking off a parent. They don't want to make a child uncomfortable. That's not to mention the chilling effect of the law on teachers who choose to keep their libraries in classroom. Wolfson says even when they're buying new books, now they're wondering, should I have this? Should I not have this? In such a charged political atmosphere, standing up for the freedom to read is no longer easy. Some librarians are reluctant to even report attempts to censor or ban books, afraid of being threatened, harassed, or fired. Case in point, only 1% of school libraries responded to the NCLA's 2024 censorship survey, which collects data on book challenges and bans. Ann Mabian, chair of that Intellectual Freedom Committee, said, talking to people, and especially with school media centers, they're just not comfortable. They're just trying to stay under the radar because they are feeling so under attack. They just want to tread really quietly. Mabian has received several reports of librarians in North Carolina being personally attacked. Perhaps not surprising, given that the state legislature proposed in April a law that would allow public schools to be sued over library books. Or, in Mabian's words, held librarians personally responsible for material that people check out. As far as advocacy is concerned, Wolfson says there are definitely some that will jump right in and be involved in change, but there are many who don't want to be involved for a myriad of reasons, and there's also a lot that are afraid. You don't want to lose your job. When it comes to dealing with censorship, a supportive community really makes all the difference, says Wolfson. If administrators and parents have your back when it comes to fighting these bans, it's easier to speak out and stand tall. On the other hand, if a librarian feels isolated, often the case in rural communities, it's that much more difficult to take action. And this article closes with Wolfson saying, I personally feel a lot of power and strength when you find your community. You can talk about these problems. We need to figure out together how we're going to fix it, make it better, who we're going to talk to, how we're going to talk to them, all of that. Well, we've been over time reading a few articles about social districts from various communities in our area, social districts being mostly related to alcoholic beverage consumption. And so here's this article that's been in the back of my folder for many weeks, and it's called Raising a Glass to Downtown. And it's a longish article, and I guess it's worth going into. Now, a lot of legal things, social mores, etc. Business owner Kat Matthias arranges supplies for the night's Bob Ross painting class at Impulsive Creativity in Mebane. The store, whose tagline is Cool Stuff from Weird People, sells work by more than 50 local artists, much of it with a gothy vibe. She runs classes in painting, wirework, and stained glass in a back room and hosts game nights. And since July 24, and students have been able to buy a beer next door at the Wooden Nickel Pub, carry it down the sidewalk, and sip it as they create, thanks to the town's social district, which allows adults to wander from business to business with an open drink in hand. And she said, I've had quite a few people who go to the bars and bring a drink in, especially on nights we play Magic, the Gathering, or Dungeons and Dragons. Being able to have that aspect of it without me having to have a liquor license is definitely a positive. Business was slow when she opened in 2018, and it truly tanked during the pandemic. Now, though, the little downtown is hopping, in part because the population of the bedroom community, located roughly halfway between Durham and Greensboro, has jumped from 15,000 to 20,000, and in big part because of efforts like the adoption of a social district. So Matthias says, things were pretty bad when I started, but traffic has really increased in the past 2 years since people have come out since COVID, and that just helps getting people into the shop. Mebane paired the launch of its social district with new outside seating areas, trash receptacles, and signage. Matthias could opt out of participating because it's voluntary by hanging a window cling stating that drinks aren't welcome. But Matthias, welcomed the idea of breathing a little life into the town center. Now, people wander into the store, drinks in hand, chat, and browse at ease. They don't spill, they don't carouse, they sip and shop. She said people who have moved into the area recently are venturing out and figuring out where the small businesses are. There's a brewery, restaurants, and plenty of events. Quote, we're all trying to keep downtown as a hopping third space. The increase in traffic has been a huge improvement for me. COVID-19 wreaked havoc on downtowns across the state, and restaurant revenue had dropped $2 billion from 2019 to 2020, according to the North Carolina Restaurant Association, and more than 60,000 jobs were lost. Other retail suffered, although there is no hard data on how many stores closed during COVID. According to Andy Ellen, president of North Carolina Retail Merchants Association, he said restaurants have to have a public health permit so they're easier to track. In September of 21, lawmakers passed House Bill 890, or the Bring Business Back to Downtown Bill, to help struggling towns and businesses. Representative Shelley Willingham, Democrat Rocky Mount, was one of the co-sponsors. And he said the idea was to come up with something that would allow the sale of alcohol in a particular area in a town or county with some restrictions. That allows some of the smaller breweries and distilleries to introduce their products and gives the town something to bring people downtown. The process of a social district is straightforward. Once a town or city council approves the idea, they file a form with the Alcohol Beverage Control Commission, delineating hours and the district's boundaries. Once that's approved, they can distribute drinks, welcome window clings to participating businesses, and specially labeled cups to ABC licensed vendors. Kannapolis, a city of around 60,000 northeast of Charlotte, was the first to hop on board, opening its district just weeks after the law passed. Its downtown was once owned by its biggest employer, Cannon Mills, and when the mill faltered, so did local businesses, says Annette Keller, director of city communications. The city then purchased the downtown and turned it into an urban park with wide sidewalks, outdoor dining, public swings, and a fountain that shoots arcs of water over pedestrians. Just imagining that. The social district was just one more tool to attract people, she said, and it worked. Quote, now you have people go into the Mexican restaurant, get a taco, and they get a beer from the brewery next door, and they enjoy themselves as their kids play in the fountains. Since then, both a brewery and a casual steakhouse have opened, as well as dress shops, boutiques, and a duck pin bowling alley. Atrium Health Ballpark, home to the Cannonballers minor league baseball team, is on the edge of the district, allowing fans to enjoy dinner downtown and carry the remains of their beer or wine as they walk to the game, though they can't take it into the stadium. Keller said, you see this whole downtown core transformed. I feel we're like in a Hallmark movie. So many people out and about, socializing, hanging around outside. Even with these districts, many downtowns are still struggling to revive foot traffic and business to pre-pandemic levels. Durham, which is home to several social districts, has had a string of restaurant closures. 50 restaurants and bars have closed since 2020, according to data from Downtown Durham Incorporated. More people working remotely and not even coming downtown has exacerbated that problem. Social districts help, said Seth Gross, owner of Bull City Burger and Brewery, but they are not a silver bullet. He says, to me, it's sort of like a cherry on top. It adds to the joy of being downtown and people being able to travel around, but it is not a huge percentage of our sales. I thought it would be more, but it's more like a handful of walking beers a week. Since 2020, 95 new restaurants and bars have opened in Durham. 49 came after the inception of the social district. Districts in 64 municipalities are now registered with the state's ABC Commission, but some of North Carolina's largest cities have held out. Winston-Salem is one that has not approved the district, in large part because its police department is spread too thin, said Economic Development Director Ken Millett. Officials worry a social district would take officers away from other parts of the city. Jason Thiel, president of the Downtown Winston-Salem Partnership, has given it a lot of thought. He says, we've had a lot number of bar owners who want to try it, but it just doesn't get past the police department. The potential for public drunkenness and open containers in parks and on streets is a concern, especially given problems with the city's unhoused population. Thiel said, if you provide this liberty to the population, it's going to be enjoyed by everyone. Still, he would support a social district and likes the idea of testing it out during special events like festivals or concerts like the annual Gears and Guitars, Cycling and Music Celebration, or a Hispanic League Fiesta. While different from social districts, the ABC Commission does issue permits for special events. Ellen from the North Carolina Retail Merchants said initial concerns about public drunkenness and its management have been overblown. Quote, he said, when some of the public hearings were held, it was always a worry that my town is going to turn into Mardi Gras or Bourbon Street, but that has not come into fruition at all. And Greensboro City Council members who are against alcohol consumption overall have stymied efforts to expand the social district and don't see why the city would want to promote drinking, said Rob Overman, vice president of Downtown Greensboro, Inc. In Asheville, leaders haven't meaningfully considered a social district designation until recently, said Councilmember Bo Hess. We haven't needed a social district, he said. We've been an active, lively place that people have loved to visit. But after the destruction from Hurricane Helene, there's more interest. Hess is enthusiastic about the idea, but he also wants more conferences, concerts, and sporting events to rejuvenate the downtown, which bring in hundreds of thousands of dollars in additional income for local small businesses. He said, we need to move away from being a beer city to more of an event city. Where they might put it, how large its boundaries would be up to debate. In my mind, it's not about where we start. We just have to start somewhere. In the last 4 years, more than 3,000 new food and drink establishments have opened across the state, according to this Restaurant and Lodging Association. While social districts are only one part of revitalization plans, many enthusiasts say they've made a difference. Lynn Minges, president and CEO of Restaurant and Lodging Association, said social districts have been helpful because they help restore consumer confidence and have brought people back downtown, giving restaurants, breweries, tap rooms, and small format food business an extra lifeline. Small rural towns credit these districts with revamping otherwise flagging downtown centers. Business owners in Wendell, a town of just under 17,000 in eastern Wake County, claim they have created a better sense of community and collaboration, said Roger Peterson, executive director of the Chamber of Commerce there. Quote, someone gave the example that if the kids are outside playing, you can go get your beverage and stand there to watch and talk with other people. Whereas if the social district wasn't in place, you'd have to cut out one or the other activity. The town's annual Harvest Festival, held each October, brings in about 10,000 people. There's an inflatable slide, miniature horses, and a stage for musicians, youth performers, and the East Wake Strutters line dance group. There are vendors, food trucks, and a parade with marching bands, scout troops, athletic teams, and kids on decorated bicycles. And Peterson said before the social district, we pulled an ABC permit and set up a beer garden, just a small fenced-in area where you could watch the band. They don't have to do that anymore. When Robin Davis bought a historic brick building in the Stanley County town of Norwood, population 2,500 in 2017, it had about three businesses and at least 18 empty businesses in its core business district. She opened a small coffee shop and started exploring rural revitalization projects elsewhere. She soon formed a nonprofit, the Central Business District Group, and started talking with locals about how to attract business. She said one of the first things that caught our eye was this little clip in the newspaper about Kannapolis. I saw this was an opportunity to use it as a catalyst to add something to our downtown that maybe other people didn't have and to be one of the first to get it implemented. A primary goal was to draw a restaurant to downtown, and a social district would help. The town council agreed, approving it in December of 2021. She said this is a low-barrier, high-impact rural revitalization tool. It has changed the public perception of downtown Norwood, attracting commerce and creativity. She said it was a fantastic tool for economic development. Quote, we literally just showed a building I own, and that was one of the first questions. Y'all have a social district here, right? Norwood's annual Arbor Day Festival traditionally drew a lot of older people listening to older music and sitting in lounge chairs. The social district changed that vibe. We've seen the age demographic of maybe 18 to 45 explode at our festivals. It has also met the group's primary goal. Lantern Sushi and Bravo's Mexican Grill have since opened downtown, and there's another restaurant under discussion. And Davis says, when I opened my building, almost all of Main Street was empty. Now, people are struggling to find spaces, and as soon as something closes down, We have something coming in right behind it. And finally, about 2 minutes left, Hatch Burritos is going to open a brick and mortar after 7 years of pop-ups in downtown Durham, North Mangum Street. They will open at 721. After 7 years of pop-ups that saw customers hopping between local spots for warm, foil-wrapped breakfast burritos stuffed with Hatch green chilies. The new space will allow customers to sit down for a smothered burrito plate or grab one to go via to curbside pickup. Owner Talitha Benjamin designed the curbside setup with early morning workers in mind, saying, "We really want to get nurses, doctors, parents, new parents, all the tradespeople." That restaurant will open at 6:30 a.m. Tuesday through Friday and at 9 a.m. on weekends. Beyond Breakfast Burritos menu items will include blue corn pancakes, yum, golden milk French toast, yum, and eggs with potatoes, as well as enchiladas, green chili stew with pork shoulder, yum, and hominy, and lunch burrito varieties like chili relleno, chicken tinga, and steak. Nearly every menu item will incorporate these Hatch chilies. They're similar to geographically branded products like Champagne or Parmigiano Reggiano. Hatch chilies only come from Hatch Valley in New Mexico. Beck Benjamin has them shipped from the source. "Everyone has green chili," said Benjamin, who spent part of her childhood in Santa Fe, says of New Mexican food, "It gets out of hand. You can find green chili white wine in New Mexico." Benjamin started Hatch in 2017 as a way to recreate the food she missed from her early years. She first sold burritos on weekend mornings at the Accordion Club. That's that Gear Street bar she founded, co-founded with Scott Ritchie, which closed earlier this year. Then expanded through pop-ups at venues like Queenie's, Local Pops, and Parker and Otis. The restaurant business runs in Benjamin's family. Her aunt and uncle owned the Washington, D.C. restaurants C.F. Folks and the Well-Dressed Burrito for decades. Benjamin's brother Aaron owns the Durham restaurant Gocciolina and has allowed Benjamin to use his kitchen as a commissary space throughout the pop-up era. And this article just concludes saying that Benjamin is aiming for a November 8th opening date. Well, you can look at your internet or consult somebody and see if it is open and get some of them Hatch chilies down your esophagus soon. And that's all for me. I'm off to eat something after all those food articles. And I'll be back next week, John Feddersen, for Indie Week. And this broadcast, which is initially broadcast on Friday, will be in our podcast section directly after that if you want to hear any of these well-read articles once again. So for the North Carolina Reading Service, I'm John Feddersen, and we wish you all a very pleasant week. And we'll be back next week with Indie Week.